Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where I take you behind the scenes of downhill and enduro mountain biking and hopefully unearth some wisdom to help you get faster on your own bike. This month, We Are One Composites are back to support the podcast. We Are One have been big supporters of what I've been doing from the start, and for that I'm super grateful. They also make amazing carbon fibre wheels which are handmade in Canada, and they've recently added their depackage bar and stem to the lineup. They hooked me up with a set of Agent 29er wheels, which I've had on my bike for nearly 2 years now, and I've literally not had to touch them. They've remained tight and true through 2 years of use and abuse, and are an absolute joy to ride. They track and hold a line incredibly well, but they're not punishingly stiff like some of the carbon wheels that I've tried. They've got a whole lineup of wheels, so there's always something to suit your needs. Just head to weareonecomposites.com and check out what they have to offer. If you're tempted, then as a Downtime listener, they've kindly offered you 15% off until 30th of April 2020. All you need to do is to use the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout. That's HANDLAID2020, all in lowercase, at the checkout on weareonecomposites.com. If you're enjoying the podcast, you're going to want to make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode and you always get them as soon as they're available. Don't rely on them always being featured on other websites. Also, you should definitely join our newsletter to receive our weekly weekend warm-up email for a few bits of interesting bike-related stuff coming to your inbox every Friday. You can do that all over at downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. Also, give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast and get involved in the conversation. All right, this week I'm joined by James McKnight, along with his business partner Ben Winder and a host of amazingly talented designers, photographers and writers. James runs Misspent Summers and is responsible for putting out the awesome downhill yearbook Hurly Burly and the equally great EWS yearbook The World Stage. James is a passionate mountain biker who's really let that passion take control of his life, and as you'll hear from this interview, it's very much shaped his career. From the early days as a seasoned air in Morzine, through finding his feet in the world of journalism, his time at the legendary Dirt magazine, and onto the creation of Misspent Summers, James's story is one that shows what you can achieve when you let your passion guide you. If you want to experience James and the team's work for yourself, and I highly recommend that you do, then as a Downtime listener, you can get 10% off anything from their bookstore by heading to misspentsummers.com and using the code DOWNTIME, all in lowercase, at the checkout before the 15th of March. All right then, it's time to get stuck into this episode. So without further ado, here's James McKnight. James McKnight, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
Very good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's been an
honour to be on here, to be honest.
Awesome. Oh, thanks, man. That's good. I'm looking forward to finding out plenty more about you, because there's certainly a lot to talk about. So let's start where we start a lot of these and chat a little bit about your background. So tell us a bit about kind of childhood and how bikes came into your life in the first place.
Yeah, well, I grew up mainly in the south of England, but also spent a couple of years in Australia when I was a kid, when I was really young. And I guess that's kind of where I really got into bikes. We lived in Adelaide and right next to a BMX track. This was when I was four till about six. And I think I just rode bikes all the time when I was there. That just started a total obsession, I guess. Then when we came back to the UK, I remember for my sixth birthday, my parents got me a mountain bike, Townsend Terminator. I remember it to this day.
Yes.
Great memories of that bike. I probably kept it far too long. I think it was minuscule when I was a bit older. But, I just rode bikes and bikes and bikes and bikes. Did loads of other sports as well. My dad was running tons of marathons when I was a kid, so I think that probably inspired me into sports. But bikes were just the main thing. I was totally obsessed. That was all I ever wanted to do.
Nice.
Yeah, when I got a little bit older, me and my mates got into racing, I suppose, and that's how the mountain biking really took over from everything.
Yeah, can you remember your first race? Was it what race was it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we must have been 12 at school and before pre-internet and all that stuff, I guess. I remember one of my mates got a flyer for a local mountain bike race, Sam's Series, and we decided we need to go and do that, really, because we just wanted to ride some real tracks. I think we'd been inspired at that point. There was a series on TV every weekend, Mountain Bike Britain, which showed the British Nationals downhill races. And the tracks just looked awesome, even though in reality, I think most of the racers probably said they were rubbish. But at that point, you know, mountain biking in the UK was pretty low key. But compared to what we've been building with kind of garden trails out in the woods near where we lived in Wiltshire, the tracks just looked incredible. So we wanted to work up to that, and we saw that there were these southern area races. Did what we did back in the day, which was post off a few quid, I think, in the, you know, a check maybe, I don't know, maybe some money in the in an envelope, whatever we did. And it's some races, and I think we weren't actually old enough to do them, so we all just pretended to be a bit older than we were. Yeah, and then I remember the first race was, it seemed like it was miles away, but it was just down the road really from where we lived. And someone's parents dropped us all off, and that was it. We were out there camping at a mountain bike race with all these cool dudes. At that point, there was a Animal Orange team. I remember we really thought they were amazing. And we were suddenly at this mountain bike race, and they were there. And we were just camping. We were 12, 13, total idiots. No idea what we were doing. I think everyone, pretty much, I think all of us, that was our first race, pretty much all of us, our chains just fell off pretty much on the start gate, and we all just did the race with the chains off the bikes. But we had an amazing time. And yeah, from then on, we just raced all the time, as much as we could coerce various parents into dropping us off at events around, mainly around the South and South Wales, not too far from home.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was a pretty good era for mountain biking in that part of the UK then, because you had the Southern Area Series, the SAM Series, and then on the more technical side of things, you had the Welsh Dragon Series as well, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably started, I can't remember that when we got into racing, I can't remember if the Dragons existed, but if they did, or it was just starting maybe the Dragon Series. And I mean, that was like another level. That just looked bonkers. And yeah, I guess second or third year of racing, we went and did some Dragons. And again, parents would just drop us off, and like for instance, just camp by the side of the fire road in Mountain Ash with our bikes in a tent and like covered in mud, probably a sandwich between us all for the weekend. It was incredible, amazing races. And yeah, the tracks were obviously mind-blowing then. We were kids who had grown up in Wiltshire, little tiny hills, and then suddenly we were in what seemed like massive mountains.
Yeah, and super technical and generally always wet as well, from what I remember.
From what I remember as well, yeah, which was great. We loved it, you know. At that point, it was just like, let's get covered in mud and go and race bikes and stand in a cattle truck or a tractor in the back of a tractor trailer, get up the hill and hang out with all these people who were, you know, they've been racing bikes and riding bikes. To us, it seemed like they were all pros, you know. We were looking up to all these people who were there racing, and we were there with them.
Yeah, but yeah, special times. And how were the results then in those early days for you?
I can't remember. I mean, as far as I know, pretty awful. Probably continued in that vein. Did a bit better when I was, yeah, I suppose in the youth and junior ranks, I did pretty well. Just in the South, seemed all right, getting on podiums and stuff like that. But in the grand scheme of things, pretty rubbish, but absolutely loved it. So just continued racing.
Yeah. And what, like in parallel, what was going on with school and college and uni or any of those kind of things? What were you interested in and what path were you following there?
So, early days school, you know, like I said, when we were 12 to 16 or whatever, doing the GCSEs, we had this big bunch of people from my town where I grew up who all rode bikes, raced bikes as much as we all could. I think everyone, to be honest, we were all obsessed with it, especially I had a kind of core group of three or four of us who, I mean, that's all we thought about, all we talked about. We'd ride to school quite often. We had two spots to ride in our local town. One of them was right by our school. So in the winter, we'd ride to school. As soon as we go out of school, just straight up the hill, ride all evening until it's dark, probably until after it's dark. Kind of even built a track. There were some street lights down the side of the bit of woods, and we even built a track that was kind of slightly lit up by the street lights. I remember one winter because we wanted to keep riding. And then we had this other spot that was about 4 miles out of town, and in the summer we'd ride there every evening and just stay there. And that was all we did. I don't remember ever doing a piece of homework, which is not necessarily I'm not saying that's something to be proud of, but you know, we had our priorities. And I was riding bikes, yeah. And then, for me, I mean, I did sixth form. That there was a kind of a funny break because, well, it's cool. Like this whole obsession led to me doing for my work experience when we were 15 or whatever. I did went and basically worked with a mountain guide in North Wales, who was a friend of my dad's, and. For a couple of weeks, and again, just eyes were open to kind of mountains, being outside, doing this whole range of outdoor sports. I remember saying to him after these 2 weeks to this guide, "I know what, I'd love to do what you're doing and be a mountain guide when I'm older. That'd be incredible." And he said to me, "You know what? I could see you've got so much passion for bikes. You'd be way better off just." Pursuing something solely in bikes, because there's no point in you trying to get into all these different sports when you've just got this, like I said, total obsession with bikes. Yeah. And that led to him basically, I can't remember how much longer, but it was before GCSE exams. He turned up on our doorstep in Wiltshire one day. I don't know what he was doing there. He was this mad guy, Nick Parks, who he's a mountain guide now and still international mountain guide, goes all over the place doing skiing and hiking and all that stuff. He just showed up on our doorstep and he said, "James, I'm not here to see your dad, I'm here to see you actually, and it's about a job in the Alps. Friend's got this company in Morzine. Don't know if you've heard of Morzine. And he's looking for someone to go and be a cleaner in a chalet for the summer. Would you be up for that?" And I was just like, "Wow, of course, of course, I've heard of Morzine." Yeah. At that point, you know, at that point, there's like one track in Morzine. There's a plenty track, and I think there were hardly any holiday companies. There was a big company in Leger that ran, and there was one company that I knew in Morzine, which is the one that I went to work for. And through that, I ended up I think it was literally the day after my GCSE exams, I got a flight out of the UK and ended up just in this chalet with basically mostly Kiwis and a few Brits who were all obviously like 20 years older than me, 10, 20 years older than me, and just some amazing people. One of those was Jason Marsh, who's Greg Menard's mechanic now. Okay. Yeah. Bardsley, and who's another Kiwi, who's pretty legendary, and a few other people. There's a guy called Rob Boone who sort of took me under his wing, and yeah, again, I think I totally lied about my age, and they thought I looked older than I was. So I mean, I think I just turned 16 before I went there, and turned up and suddenly thrown into cleaning a 22-bedroom hotel as a job, and being paid pocket money. I think I was actually being paid. It was pretty funny. I remember the guy I was sharing a room with telling me that I was getting paid more than him, and he was like I said, 20 years older than me or something, because he was washing pots and I was cleaning the whole chalet, or trying to. Obviously didn't know how to probably change a bed at that point, but... Yeah, and that just led to summers in Morzine, basically. I ended up, at the end of that summer, I thought, I'll stay here forever and just do this. And then something, I'd even forgotten about my GCSEs. I remember my mum and dad had to phone up the reception at this hotel and all the sort of people running the hotel, and they said, "Oh, James, do you know you got your GCSE results?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'd completely forgotten."
Awesome.
So I have my parents telling me those down the phone. I don't know if I even ever picked up the certificates, but shouldn't say that, obviously. Yeah, and I thought I'd stay there forever, but then something at the end of that summer, I just thought, oh, you know what? It's my last chance to get free education with going to sixth form. And I'd suddenly, obviously being in France, I suddenly realised that education is actually pretty important and that I could do something useful in sixth form, which was to learn French. And so I ended up going back to UK, doing sixth form, but going back out to Morzine every summer, sort of from then on.
That's a pretty early start in the season air kind of way of life.
Yeah, I think I can remember, I don't know if it was the first night I was there, but one of the first nights I probably shouldn't have been drinking so much for a 16-year-old. this is a horrible story, actually, but I went back, like I said, to this house I was sharing with these Kiwis like Marshy and this guy Toolby. So I shared a room with kind of old Rocco to the world, playing his bass guitar with his band, and then ended up in Morzine. So I really looked up to this guy. I was probably a little bit intimidated at first. Turned up in the bedroom that I was sharing, the room that I was sharing with him. I remember he was just there sort of strumming his guitar. And he looked at me and he went, "You all right?" I said, "Yeah, fine." And Ben was just massively sick across the room. and then fell over in it. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm making a complete idiot myself. But he was just laughing. He found it hilarious. And again, another person who sort of really looked after me then and helped me out that summer sort of with a rapid period of growing up over a couple of months.
Yeah.
Lots of mistakes made, I'm sure.
It's inevitable, but yeah, like you say, it fast forwards things a bit, doesn't it, I guess, and you learn a lot pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's quite good. One of my best mates come out in the summer to see me for a week, and that inspired him as well to get into doing this sort of stuff. And we're both now still floating around the Alps and various mountains in Europe, and that's really cool that friends from childhood are still into it as well.
Yeah, definitely. So what happened once you'd finished sixth form then? Was it like a permanent move out to the Alps or not?
Well, we hadn't just got into riding and drinking and stuff like that. We'd been racing all through sixth form. We were completely obsessed with racing still. We're doing more and more. And then as soon as we learned how to drive, I mean, then literally... my best mate and I, at the time, Pedro, like I said, who's still out here now, who also grew up in the same town as me. I remember I had a driving test booked, and we'd sort of said to each other, like, oh, we could go over and do a race in Portugal. Could road trip down there maybe when I pass my test. And it transpired that we'd had to got the ferry the day after my driving test. So we ended up doing that. We ended up booking this ferry the day after my driving test. Obviously, before I'd taken the driving test, completely just hoping. And in my driving test, I think I was like, oh, my God, if I fail this now, that's going to be, you know, it probably wasn't much money, really. But at the time, it seemed like an enormous amount of money thrown away. Luckily, I passed, and the next day we drove down to Portugal, and I'd sort of stolen my sister's Ford Fiesta, which I ended up completely destroying, which I apologise to her for now. yeah, and we ended up, that was the first time we went to one of these international races, and we drove down to Gouveia in Portugal. And again, that was like another step up, seeing these awesome tracks and bigger hills, higher speeds. And you're sort of part of a bigger event, and that just got us into traveling around Europe, doing races around Europe, mainly focused on doing races. I think probably the racing thing was, you know, we were doing all right sometimes, but not in the grand scheme of things, not really particularly great. But like I said, community, being able to ride new tracks, especially at a time when the scene was still really growing. And you couldn't just pitch up at any old resort anywhere and find a ton of tracks like you can now. You know, you really had to go to races to get uplifts and decent tracks. So yeah, for the next, I guess until about mid-20s really, we were still traveling around tons racing.
Yeah, you worked your way up into expert though in the UK, which is, that's pretty high standard, isn't it?
Yeah, it was all right. Yeah, it was decent. Did some all right results. In Europe, you just sort of turn up and they ask you what category you're in. So you just go, oh, I'm elite. So we just raced with all the big guys in Europe. So that was cool. I got on some podiums. Did basically as a junior, was doing all right and got some UCI points. That was before there was a junior category in the World Cups, and I sort of tried my hand at racing some World Cups against all the pros and stuff. Just didn't go that well, but you know, that was a good experience.
What was that like? Because that's a huge step up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was bonkers. The first one that I did was in Fort William. I did it with a friend, Al Evans. Actually, I had my 18th birthday there, I think, and obviously didn't qualify because. But we weren't that far. Neither of us qualified, but we weren't that far off. You know, racing against all the pros. There were, you know, 80 people qualified at that point, so it wasn't, you know, at that point it seemed like impossible to do that. But it was an amazing experience. Even just doing that, riding in front of so many people was incredible. Noise at Fort William, just being that side of the tapes was cool. I tried my best to do more World Cups after that, but started having loads of injuries, started being more and more skint basically as well, and trying to get to races, sometimes not able to get to races. It was hard to get UCI points, like it still is obviously, but there were hardly any events, so not necessarily that many of my mates got them. I was lucky to get them a couple of times, so you know, getting a van full of your mates together wasn't that easy to go to a race, so then the costs just go up.
Yeah,
and a few of my good friends did a couple of seasons really of racing World Cups, and again, like I said, I tried, but just ended up having injuries pretty much all the time.
But yeah, and so at some point you set up a guiding business. How did that come about?
So I think in all our road tripping, at some point I'd met this guy called Rick in Morzine, and who we sort of shared a chalet with at some point, he went and bought a house or a flat in the south of Spain, invited me on a holiday down there in the winter. He's like, do you want to come down? It's pretty sunny. I guess this is just when we were pretty young, we were 18, 19. He's like, yeah, come down if you want. There's a space if you want to come and kip down here. Went down to south of Spain, and at some point, I think just driving to the airport, we saw this gondola going over the road, which is in Benalmadena, Malaga, which is the place that everyone now goes to ride downhill. And we were like, wow, that's amazing. There's a gondola. I wonder if we can get on that. And we pitched up at the gondola one day, and they were like, yeah, you can take bikes up there. You'll have to pay for a year's pass for this gondola. It's 50 euros for the year. We're like, okay, cool. To cut a few stories short, ended up living down there with mates, living for about 20 euros a week. It was amazing. And wow. Somehow met Mike Saunders, this guy who owns Switchbacks, which was still a big bike holiday company. At that point, it was like the company in the south Spain if you wanted to go and ride in the dry in the winter. And I ended up working as a guide for him for quite a long time, sort of on and off. Mainly during the winters, which was incredible. So living in the south Spain, riding bikes every day, riding with amazing people who come out on holiday, who are having a good time, and getting paid a little bit for it as well. Through that, you know, got all the guiding qualifications, and at some point, I guess it was when there was a financial crash, there wasn't any work for me anymore down the south of Spain, and suddenly ended up stuck in the UK. So thought, oh, I'll put out a couple of flyers just to see if I can get any coaching or guiding work in the UK. And I did that, put some in my mate's bike shop, Sean Ratton's bike shop, in Wiltshire. And pretty quickly had a few clients for coaching, including a local school that got me doing guiding and coaching. So that sort of became my own little company for a couple of years. And I was still traveling around loads. Had a good friend, Claude, working with me as well for a little while. I suppose that was the first taste of sort of running my own company.
Yeah. At some point alongside that, the journalism thing started to grow. How did that come about? Was it Descent World, the first kind of writing that you did?
It was all sort of intermingled. So I'm telling many stories sort of at the same time here. But again, when we'd gone down to Spain and we started riding the south of Spain, and there was kind of, that was completely unknown for Brits at that point. You know, obviously there were tons of Brits abroad living it up down there with their full English lifestyles, but that was the first time that we knew of that sort of mountain bikers from Britain were going down there. And we started building some tracks and stuff, and it was quite cool. And I'd spoken to Cy Payton, who was, along with John Beckett, who at that point they were both running Descent World, which was the sort of the big website, the big place for gravity riders at that point.
Yeah.
And I guess Peyton maybe suggested it, just to write some stuff for the website, because I said I was going down to Spain. I think, or maybe I had just asked him, you know, maybe this is something you might be interested in. He's like, yeah, that'd be amazing. Just do it. Just write some stuff, send it in, and we'll get it on the website. So I did, and I started this little column called Europikey for Descent World.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah. Great. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing when people say they remember stuff like that. It's like, wow, that's cool. Even if it's one person, you think, well, that's great. If I mean, maybe you didn't enjoy it, but maybe you remember it. Someone says like, oh, it kind of got me, it inspired me to do a road trip or something, then I'm like, oh, that's incredible, even if it's one person.
Yeah, definitely. And Descent World was like you say, it was the go-to for that side of the sport at that point in time. Yeah, it was a pretty big deal, really.
It was. I was so proud to have features on the website. It was incredible. It was funny. At that point, I mean, I grew up, I mean, my family's all pretty anti-technology. I didn't have a computer or anything. So I was having really good fun doing it. And my mate, Cy Dalton, who I went down there with, he was taking photos. He was quite good at taking photos. So he'd do that. I'd just write a story on a notepad. I'd go buy a notepad, write it all down. And then I'd get a few euros and go to an internet cafe and just sit there for like 2 hours trying to type this thing up in a rush, trying not to waste any money on the internet costs, and then quickly send it off to someone at Descent World and it would go on the website. And it was incredible watching it. Yeah, it was amazing to see it go on there. Like I said, really proud to have that on there. And that kind of got me hooked on really doing cool stuff like that, just writing stories about mountain biking. And I kind of thought, oh, you know, there's something more to what we do than just going and riding the bikes. There's a story behind every ride, and maybe I can tell that and hopefully inspire some people to go and ride their bikes as well.
Cool. And did the writing come naturally to you once you started?
I think it did. Yeah, I really enjoyed. Like I said, I really enjoyed it. I think everything that I was doing in my life apart from that was really physical. So it was doing sports or doing building jobs to get some money and stuff like that. So I was knackering myself out all the time. And then to have a kind of outlet that where you're not doing sport was good as well to occupy your mind. I think I really enjoyed writing when at school as well. I just had this one. I remember writing this thing at school once and loved it, loved doing it. And teacher just sort of said, it's rubbish, you know, you're not cut out for this. And I remember I was like heartbroken then. And luckily, like I said, luckily, Cy Payton sort of said, yeah, why don't you have a go at doing this writing? And I found that love for it again. And yeah, that's been one of my two passions since then, riding bikes and writing about them, really.
Yeah, and that led you to writing a whole book for, was it Crowood Press?
God, yeah. I hope no one looks that up. That's embarrassing. But I did, yeah.
It's a proper old school mountain bike book, that one.
It is. I mean, it's probably not as old as it looks. It was just that the publishing company was a bit stuck in their ways. But that was great. That actually came up again because of local bike shop in Wiltshire, local to where I grew up. My friend Sean, who had the bike shop, who is someone who I have to say thanks to, because again, he supported me through all the racing and everything like that, and would never have been able to do any of it without his help. They had approached him, I think, and said, do you want to write this, or do you know anyone who might want to? And he'd passed that job to me. And that was really a big step up for me, because there was a great editor at the publishing company called Hannah Shakespeare, which was pretty funny. And she was really good to work with, and she gave me a great, really good sort of list of how to put something like that together, a project like that together, how to structure everything you do, how to present it, how to deliver it. Something that I've never had in any other industry that I've worked in. No one's ever been that thorough. And that just allowed me to put the manuscript for the book together in a way that she was happy with. And that, like I said, that really showed me how to put a product like that together. And I learned a lot from that. Even though, like I said, it's an embarrassing dread for people to go and look at that book, because it was pretty embarrassing. But
so should we leave that link out of the show notes then?
Yeah, let's.
All right, fair play. And then at some point, Factory Media became part of your life. How did that come about?
I can't remember when that came about. Again, probably in the south of Spain. I can't remember what order it all happened in, but knew Steve Jones, who was obviously the sort of one of the faces of Dirt at the time, Dirt Mag. Actually met him for the first time. I mean, I've probably never told him this, but the first time I ever met him, I think I was 14. I was at this race in, I can't remember where it was, near Reading, which I think you're from that area, aren't you?
Checkenden, it would have been.
There you go. And we actually met Steve. We knew who Steve was because we'd seen him on Mountain Bike Britain again, like I said. And he just turned up, he kind of walked out of the bushes, which is not a strange story for Steve. That's quite standard for Steve, that sort of thing. And he was standing in the middle of the track and he goes, "Excuse me, boys, do you know where the track is?" And we just said, standing on it, actually, mate. Oh, okay. And I thought, blimey, that was funny. Yeah, anyway, and then met Steve properly a few years later, I guess, when I was down in Spain, bumbling around. I can't remember how it happened exactly, but ended up getting into a couple of photo shoots, doing shoots for Dirt, for bike tests and travel features and stuff like that. Like I said, I was basically living up in the mountains in Spain at that point, though, in a little village called Bubion, which is miles and miles from anything, kind of crazy place at the end of the world. I guess Steve came down there as well. Maybe I met him then. And at some point in all this, I ended up writing features for Dirt. And then Mike Rose, who's this kind of, you know, the legendary editor of Dirt, some point he sent me a message and said, "Do you actually want to write a column for Dirt?" so I started writing EuroPikey for Dirt instead.
Yeah.
Sort of stopped doing it online at that point. And then they needed someone to do Dirt 100, put the book together at some point. And they asked me if I wanted to do that. And I'd already done that book for Crowwood Press, like I said. So I sort of had a vague idea how to do it, but not really a clue. But ended up getting roped into that and spending quite a bit of time at the Dirt office. And that turned into a job at Factory, which kind of wangled my way in working for Bike Magic, which was a website that had been massive sort of in the early days of websites, but gone completely dormant. And they got me in as the editor, which was really a way of me just working for Dirt, but not being on the payroll. So I was at the Dirt office working for Dirt, running Bike Magic as well, not Bike Radar, working two jobs basically. And it was great. That turned into some of the best times of my life, working for Dirt, working with all the crew down there. Mike, Steve, Billy, obviously, hopefully everyone remembers, because he kind of started Dirt's website and it was brilliant when he did it. Ed, Jack Quinn, Winder, and Ali Todd, legendary Ali Todd. So that turned into three years really working at Dirt until the end, until it kind of went down the pan.
Yeah, so you ended up as assistant editor towards the end of that. That must have been a dream job, but a tough time, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, every part of working for Dirt was a dream job. Didn't really, probably never dreamt of it beforehand, because it just didn't seem like something that I'd end up doing. But like I said, suddenly ended up working at Dirt, which was based in Monmouth in South Wales, beautiful surroundings, amazing team of people, right, who just obviously completely wild. If anyone who's ever been to the Dirt office would remember it as just total chaos. Chaos and cakes, I think, is probably a way to describe it. but brilliant, absolutely brilliant times working there. It changed, like I said, it changed pretty quickly in the time I was working there. I was, like I said, started off and Billy was still there running the website, feeding the beast, as he would repeatedly call it. And he'd be, you know, throwing a shovel over his shoulder when he's saying that, just piling stuff on. It sort of changed. I think the website had already changed then from Billy doing some brilliant stuff, hilarious, brilliant stuff and great features on the website and starting off the whole Dirt TV thing, to suddenly the publishing company thinking, oh, right, we need to be getting some numbers on here. Need to just have more and more and more and more stuff on the website, which is kind of the model of most websites now. You know, it's like, okay, let's get advertising. We just need clicks, 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 clicks. Don't care what you're doing. Just need to put more stuff on there.
Mm-hmm.
That led to Billy just leaving, which is totally, totally understandable. He just wanted to go and work on a whacker plate at Bike Park Wales, which is what he did. And he was so happy after doing that. Then there's suddenly a few of us running the website and, like I said, running Bike Magic still and all working on Dirt Mag as well. And then stuff just started quickly changing and, you know, different people sort of coming in and out of the company higher up, which is never a good sign. But slimming down teams, which kind of led to quite a lot of changes. But yeah, I was assistant editor at the end, maybe deputy at the end. Titles were nothing really. It didn't really matter there. Everyone was doing everything. It all changed quite a lot by then. But
sad to leave it behind.
Yeah, well, I mean, the day that someone from London, so, you know, obviously we had the office down in Monmouth. Factory had this big fancy office in the most expensive part of London, which was obviously a massive drain of the resources. I think Dirt was actually profitable and probably holding up quite a lot of the company. But they came down completely unannounced one day and got us all into a meeting room and just said, we're shutting down the mag, which was a pretty sad day, obviously. Pretty shocking for all of us. Yeah. No one knew that was going to happen at all. And then it all went online and people lost their jobs and stuff like that, which obviously wasn't that much fun. But yeah, it was a sad day. People sort of say that's inevitable, that sort of thing. But like I said, Dirt was doing really well. And the main reason that shut down, as far as I understand, is that the company as a whole was really leaky, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Wasting money all over the place. And Dirt was one of the brands that was really holding it up, doing a good job, probably because Mike and Steve were kind of militant in not accepting any bullshit from London, basically, from the publisher. They stuck to their guns, kept the magazine quality, cool, core, and people still loved it and had such a big influence on the whole mountain biking scene.
Massively.
Yeah.
It was a sad day to see that go. And then you kind of moved on and did freelance writing bits and pieces for various different people. But then Misspent Summers became a thing, or was her, like, what came first, Misspent Summers or Hurley Burley? Like, how does that all fit together?
Yeah, like most things in my life, I suppose it's kind of a big jumbled spaghetti mess of stories. I can't remember what year it was, but at some point before I was working for Dirt, I decided I was going to do a book called Misspent Summers, which was just going to be all about the kind of people who inspired me in Morzine, who were total lifers, living out in the Alps to ride bikes, basically, doing whatever they could to get by so that they could ride bikes, live in a great place, have a good lifestyle. So I was going to do this book, and I wrote most of it and got some artwork done by Fen Monet, and got a load of photography done, got this really good, two really good photographers in, actually. Like, got one guy, Damien, who's local to Morzine, and another guy, James Bowden, who actually travelled there to do a load of the photography for it. Never actually got around to publishing it. Tried to get a couple of publishers to help me out with it. Didn't really happen. But kind of still wanted to do something with that. And after the mag had closed at Dirt, and a few of us stayed on just running the website for a year or so, I was pretty, just wasn't satisfied doing the website. It was just, like Billy would always say, just feeding the beast, chucking stuff on there. There's always someone wanting more stuff, and all of the anything you actually take any time over just disappears anyway in a couple of days, or, you know, completely flunks, or like I said, or all the publisher sort of says, oh, what are you doing that for, when it's not getting any views? That's just worthless.
Yeah.
So that made me want to do, I just wanted to do something more meaningful. So even then, like when I was still there, I was thinking about doing something, doing a book, quitting and doing something that would actually be sustainable as well in the long run. I feel like I'm just doing shouts here, but friend Chris Jackson had sort of said to me, oh, if you do want to do something in print, or you want to do your own company or whatever, make sure you think really hard about what it is, and you probably have to sort of reinvent how it's done, or do something that no one else is doing, because there's no point in doing a website because there's already loads of them. There's no point in doing a magazine because there are quite a few of them and most of them are struggling anyway, and just jumping into a market that's already saturated is a kind of pointless exercise. So I was thinking about how I could do something different, and not exactly revolutionary doing a yearbook. It's something that's existed forever and in various sports, and even in mountain biking there was one ages ago. But I guess maybe we talked about it in the Dirt office as well, sort of said it'd be cool to do something, an annual. Got the idea in my head, and spoke to some photographers at some point at World Cup, to the guys who became the photographers, which are Sven, Boris and Seb, and started off with Duncan Philpott as well. So sort of said, might want to do this, might do it through dirt, but might just go our own way. Do you want to be, would you be up for doing something like that? And they sort of said, yeah, definitely, which was cool. But then it all changed a bit when I left dirt, because obviously suddenly then it was like relying on someone who's not gone about this alone before. Mike and Steve were still working at dirt, so they weren't really going to be part of the thing to start with, not officially anyway. So I think the photographers there had to put a lot of faith in me sort of winging it on my own, I think. But yeah, like I said, well, I feel like I'm getting really confusing in my stories here, but
you're all good.
Long story short, it's about a year after left dirt, finally got everything together so that we could actually do something, do a book. Dirt was still going even then, and I didn't really believe that it was possible to do it just as an independent publisher coming from nowhere, absolutely skint. Like I said, thankfully photographers were still really into it and they were willing to sort of get involved even without me sort of having any CV in doing that. And at first got this whole idea together for Hurly Burly, which has become the downhill yearbook. That was the first one. And I'd spoken to a couple of publishers about that as well. And someone from one publisher was actually really keen to do it, but then their financial director got involved and killed that idea because of their boring logic, which was that obviously, why would you do that? And then I went back to actually Factory, the dirt publisher, and said, look, I'm going to do this yearbook. Maybe we could do it with Factory actually as an official thing. And they were really interested, obviously, because their sort of eyes lit up with the dollar signs.
Yeah.
And they offered like absolute pittance to put this thing together, and they would have ended up owning it. And I was kind of offended by it, and I thought, you know what, just going to do it myself. And then, so okay. 2016, just ended up working my ass off for a few months, saving up some money, getting enough to be able to print a couple thousand copies, basically, to do the first edition of the book. And obviously, like I said, there's a lot of just me putting well, sort of gambling on it, and also a lot of other people putting their faith into me, like the photographers, Chris, the designer, all the contributors who helped write it, and a couple of brands who actually, you know, put their hands in their pockets and put a bit of money into it without sort of knowing what was going to happen. Thankfully, that went really well, and I in the first place, I was thinking, you know what, if we sell one of these, I'll count that as a success, because if we sell one, that means that it can become something.
Yeah, and someone wants it.
Exactly. And I put it on sale kind of late. It was December the 6th, I think, something like that. Thought, you know, it's a great product for Christmas. Got to get out there before Christmas. Been working, Chris, the designer, and I have been working just mad for a few weeks, just all day, every day. Leave the office middle of the night, get up, get the back of there early, just drinking coffee basically for 3 weeks straight. Actually managed to get this book together, got it on sale, and I think it was about a minute after I put it on sale, Remy Tyrion bought a copy. He's the first person to buy a copy of the book. And
nice.
I saw that come in and I thought, wow, that's amazing. That's something that's actually going to work. Someone's actually bought one. And yeah, we got tons of orders straight away. I think Danny Art's dad was the second person to buy one. literally, like I said, a minute after I put it on sale. And that was incredible. Gambled so much and put so much work into it by that point. I'm so stressed. then it actually looked like it was going to work, and that did really well. The first book did really well and managed to pay everyone a little bit, pay myself back for the print, pay my girlfriend Morgan back because she put in a bit of money for the print as well because I couldn't quite get enough. And yeah, counted that as a big success, really.
Yeah, that is a big success. What, so why print? Why? What was it that drew you to making a physical product rather than something online?
Yeah, like I said, you do something online and it just disappears in seconds, and then it's always susceptible to this kind of to falling into the numbers game where you just start seeing these big numbers that websites and social media and YouTube and stuff give you, that where you start expecting hundreds of thousands of views, which you don't even know what that really means. And I thought, we just want to do something more meaningful, something that's future proof, that in 10 years people will still be able to look at, and something that tells the history of the sport, because it's something that's obviously important to all of us, is the way the sport progresses. Everyone who's involved has been in mountain biking for quite a long time, and it's you know, runs in our veins, as they say. That was, to me, when people say it's illogical to do print stuff, to me it was the most logical one, because like I said, in 10 years that book will still exist. In 10 years will the feature that you read on X mountain bike website this morning, will that still exist? Will you be able to find it? Will it still work on your device? Probably not. So for us, that, for me and for everyone else who's got involved, that was actually a logical path to go down. And then with the yearbooks, to make them kind of, to make it sustainable, it was like, don't want to do a magazine, because magazines depend so much on sort of current events, and it's hard to go back and buy a, if there's a new magazine out, you probably won't buy one from the month before. But
yeah,
doing stuff that's kind of timeless, that was kind of a goal, to make products that in 10 years you could still buy. 2016 downhill yearbook, hopefully people still buy it in 10 years. That was the aim, is to always have a few in stock that people can go back and buy if they discover the brand in a few years or something. And suddenly relive that season in mountain biking. You look back.
I was just going to say, do you still get sales then of some of the older Hurley Burleys and stuff? Are people still buying them?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, like I said at the start, I hoped that was how it would happen. And it is. And it's great now, you see when people discover the brand. I mean, it's amazing. I have to say thank you to everyone who buys stuff from us. You see people discover the brand and they'll go on there, and some people buy every single book that we make now in one hit. So you know they've just discovered it.
Awesome.
And you know that they're excited by it. They're investing hundreds of pounds in our business because they believe in what we're doing. And that's really amazing. I know I would. I mean, I know if I saw something similar from another sport or from a different area of the sport from a few years ago, I'd buy it. So I think there are other people like me out there.
And almost the further away from that date you get, the more interesting it is in a way. Like if there was a Hurley Burley from kind of 95 or something, that would be a really cool thing to look at now.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Maybe as we go further into the future, the older stuff will become even more popular.
I think in, like you said, in 10 years, you suddenly go, 2016 downhill season, what was that all about? And then you look back at the book and you go, wow, that was a big season. That was, people might not remember, but that's all the stuff that's in that book. It sort of serves as a history book of that season in mountain biking.
Yeah, definitely. So how has it all progressed then? Because Miss Spent Summers from that original Hurley Burley has grown quite a bit.
Has. probably looks like it's grown more than it has. it's great. That was the idea was basically, and I'd read this somewhere before, that digital companies, you expect them to explode from the start, and if they don't, then you're doing something wrong. Analog companies, you got to take your time and build up this kind of authentic brand and have a solid base behind it. So the goal from the start was, don't expect to have massive financial success now or ever, really. If we don't have to borrow any money and don't lose money, then that's a success. And take your time, gradually build it up, add products to what we do, keep making quality, timeless products. Never kind of start down a slippery slope, like I said, chasing numbers. So that led to us sort of adding different books to the portfolio. Really lucky in the first year, so did that first book end of 2016. In 2017, Death Grip movie was put out by Brendan and Clay Porter, and they asked us to do a book about the film. So that was great. Mm-hmm. That was a great opportunity to do that. Worked with John Gregory on that one, another designer. And SKP, Australian brand, which is kind of storytelling about mountain biking. Damien Breach, he asked us to turn his website into something, like I said, timeless, future-proof. So we ended up turning his website into annual, which is SKP Anthology, which is a beautiful photo book about mountain biking. So we were lucky then that we had a bit of a foot up to straight away add a couple more titles to the portfolio without the massive cost, because those guys covered them. So very fortunate with that. And then thought logical thing is to follow more race series like we do with the Downhill World Cup. So Enduro World Series is close to all our hearts, and Sven and Boris and Seb will follow the series. So we started doing the World Stage Enduro World Series book. And yeah, just gradually building the company up in ways that, you know, we have a relatively small audience, but people who kind of enjoy what we do and like to be part of it. And we thought we need to get some merchandise and stuff like that, because that's what everyone does. And a way of way of people kind of getting more involved with the brand. So we've done that, and we've added merchandise, and now we've been fortunate enough that Tom Caldwell, amazing filmer who did the Slice of British Pie series, and he actually interned at Dirt when he was studying film. He's come back and said, look, last year the guys want to do a film with Miss Spencer Summers, which is amazing. Like, amazing step up for us to go to another medium, like I said, that's, it'll live online, but it's a film. It was something that, even if the internet doesn't exist in 10 years, that film, you know, he'll still have it, and people can still watch it somehow. It'll be a way, it'll have a way of existing. It's not just a 30-second edit on Instagram that dies in a day and a half.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's cool. He was inspired by the fact that we're independent, and we haven't got publishers breathing over our shoulders all the time, and we can kind of do stuff the way we want to do it. And Tommy's got his own ideas about film and how he wants to do it, and we weren't going to impose any sort of rules on Tommy and how he does his new film, which is called Tea and Biscuits. And so it just gave him complete creative freedom to make the film, which I think is why he wanted to get involved with us. But it's great. I mean, like I said, from our point of view, brilliant, because Miss Spencer Summers has just gone down another avenue there, which is something that we love, which is full-length films, and in a style that we love, which is Tommy's filming style.
Yeah, and, I've just seen the trailer for that, and it looks awesome.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, the film, it's quite different to Slice of British Pie films. It's got some of the same riders, some new riders and quite a different edit style. Okay. Different sort of soundtrack going through it, and it's a real variety of riding, and it's super cool. We're really happy. We've just Windows, who's a business partner, Windows and I have just seen Tommy's sort of final edit of it, and it's brilliant. It's really cool, super funny, amazing, inspiring riding, some wild moments, some crazy hucks by people like Adam Brayton. You'll have to see the film.
Yeah, so it's premiering this Friday, I think, isn't it? 6th of March at Llandegla.
That's right, yeah. So that's going to be an amazing event. Like awesome. I said again, another step up for us, for a company. Just like, wow, suddenly we're an event. I mean, it's Tommy's film. He's done all the hard work, but we've sort of riding his coattails, and has misspent summers, and cool to be part of that. And yeah, we'll be there with our books and all that stuff.
Good stuff. So is it tough kind of financially to make the whole thing work? Because people will say that print is dead. I don't believe that. I think it's just more difficult, and you have to think about it in a different way, which you guys have been doing. But is it still kind of challenging to make it work financially?
Yeah, it depends on your expectations. I think when people say it's tough to make it happen, that's usually because they're expecting to get rich off it, or they're expecting to have a good time just, you know, doing a magazine. Like dirt from the outside, actually, and from the inside, looked like a good time. But you know, Mike Rose was holding that together and doing a hell of a lot of work. Like you and Steve Jones were doing a lot of work, but Mike was there in the office, really sort of holding down the fort. But so that's the kind of work side. From the financial side, people, yeah, like I said, expectations. Big publishers expect to make loads of money so they can pay their directors a fat paycheck every now and then. But if you're doing something independently like this, we've got, you know, we haven't got many big overheads. We all love what we're doing. And luckily we're making a product that brands kind of want to get involved with. So we're getting a bit of help from the bike industry to make it happen. We're not, like I said, depends what you call success or what you class as success or failure, really, when you talk about the financials of it, because I've never been paid from the company still, but it's going, and we managed to pay contributors and photographers a little bit more every year, and they get paid pretty well compared to some. Well, actually, I say that we should be paying them more, but still, but compared to the dismal rates of some titles out there, we still pay all right.
Yeah,
and it's our goal just to keep, which we've managed to do every year, just to keep building it up slowly and paying everyone a bit better and a bit better until it's a kind of serious job for everyone, where they're making decent money out of it, enough to actually be really sustainable.
Yeah.
Awesome. So yeah, expectations, really.
If you can put a roof over your head and feed yourself and have a bike, that's all you need, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we all do freelance work. You know, we're not trying to do it as a full-time thing, because as soon as you dive into it like that, then you're putting loads of pressure on the company to make enough money to be able to put food on the table. We all have our freelance jobs, and we all make salaries or make enough money in that way so that we can keep doing these projects and making sure, like I said, that there's no pressure on the company and no sudden need to lower our kind of values of the company and go to any desperate measures like most media brands do to sort of try and survive. But because like I said, they're expecting to make loads of money out of it, but we're not at the moment.
Cool, fair play. And what are the plans for the future then? What sort of stuff would you like to be doing in a few years' time, and where would you like to see it?
Well, it's cool. We're growing slowly, adding some more titles to the portfolio, and just keep building on that really, and keep reaching. We still, I mean, we sell sort of in the low thousands numbers of books, a few thousand books of each title,
mm-hmm.
Which is super cool. Just to think there's that many people want to buy them. At the same time, when you read other people's circulation numbers for magazines and stuff, you think, oh, we're tiny. We still think there are a lot of people out there who we haven't reached, and we want to just keep reaching more people, which, like I said, when you see someone suddenly go online and buy our whole catalogue of books, you realise that they've probably never seen the brand now until now.
Yeah.
So that's it, just keep expanding, keep reaching new people, but not lowering our values of what we do. Doing more travel stuff. This year we're doing travel guides, which we've just started doing. So that's a little bit more kind of putting our slant on the classic travel guide, which is storytelling, a bit of humour, nice photos, nice design. So
you've just done something for Punta Ala, is it, I think?
Exactly, yeah. So that's a destination I work with. So that's a kind of, like I said, always been lucky forever to have sort of a little foot up from people or brands or whatever. And I've been working with Punta Ala for a few years. That's the place that hosted the first ever Enduro World Series in 2013. And just sort of helping guide them a little bit on direction of their resort and trails and marketing and stuff like that. And fortunately, they were happy to kind of invest into doing our first trail guide for them. And we put this thing out just recently, actually. So it's a little kind of A5 sized light guide, some stories, some ideas of trails. We don't expect people to navigate from them because Trail Forks is amazing for that. So we thought there's no point in trying to create a kind of book of maps. We'll just do something that hopefully inspires people to go and ride in a new place and tells them about it. We want to do them independently. That's our goal, is just to do them completely independently, where we go on a trip, we review a place, and we tell people exactly how it is. Like no influence from the destination. That's our ideal goal. Because that was cool. That was cool, you know, features in Dirt in the past and stuff that I know I was inspired by when I'd read a road trip or something. And people just going out there living like dirt bags, riding these amazing new trails all around Europe and further afield, and partying and having a good time. That's kind of what we want to be able to do through our own guides.
Sounds good to me. So I was going to ask you whether the freelance kind of lifestyle chose you or you chose it, but having chatted for an hour or so, I get the feeling that it chose you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky to be able to do the freelance lifestyle because, luckily being able to find enough work to keep afloat, kind of, and like I said, I'm not particularly qualified in anything. So luckily I've worked my way through an industry and picked up my skills as I go along, and contacts, and get enough work now to work freelance. But that's a nice position to be in.
And if you, I don't have has to it ever choose, caused choose a salary. Has it ever caused worries? Like, have you ever kind of got to the point where you're like, I can't see how I'm going to live next month, sort of thing?
Only really constantly, but that's all. just all the time, that's all. But tough. It's tough. I say it's tough. I mean, it's not that tough, is it? I mean, I'm still in a house, and as long as I'm not starving, then it's not that tough. But sometimes it's hard, especially when you're like a big brand owes you loads of money and they're not paying you and stuff like that. And you're just thinking, flipping it. I'm an individual. I really rely on this small amount of money. And that happens. I mean, everyone who I know who's freelance, that happens too, that they're always owed money by companies and stuff. And it's always a little bit of a worry. You know, you never know you never know if you're going to suddenly run out of work. If you're doing just, if you're just going from my point of view, I'm just writing articles for brands and media outlets. You don't know if suddenly they're going to change their whole structure and not need you anymore. So that's kind of worrying, but at the same time, I've done it for a while now, and you start to realise that actually it doesn't really work. Like once you've got, if you're trying to do good work, people realise that, and word gets around, and you start getting more jobs come up. So I think as long as you respect the people you work for, then more work will come up in the future anyway, even if it's not from the same company.
Yeah, and plenty of upsides to that way of life as well, the flexibility and everything that comes with it.
Exactly, yeah. My long-time girlfriend, Morgan, she races bikes for a living, so we travel around a lot, and I can take the work with me, which is amazing. If I had a salary, you know, sometimes you think, God, I just need to get a salary job, and then there's no worries every month. You know when you're getting paid. But then you realise actually how much of a luxury this lifestyle is. So can't complain about that at all.
Good stuff. All right. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but got a few. We've got our usual four questions, but I also want to ask you what you think mountain biking is doing well at the moment and what you think it could maybe do a bit better.
I think people like the 50-1 crew are doing an amazing job of inspiring people to ride their bikes without needing the latest technology. I think that's super cool. So many kids who are getting inspired to ride bikes through them and just go out and mess around and have fun. I think that's super cool. I think mountain biking at the same time will forever be inventing too many new standards. So that's, if I was going to say the flip side of it, that's an easy one. And we're still getting punctures. So that's another thing mountain biking could improve.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'd like to see the back of that for sure. Yeah. Cool. All right, well, we hit up our four usual questions. So first one of those, if our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance or their enjoyment of riding, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
Yeah, definitely just some coaching. Like, it's amazing how, look at a pro in any sport still has a coach, you know, someone, a skills coach, because as much as you think you know how to do something or you think you're doing it well, someone else looking at your technique and telling you how to improve it is priceless. And for 150 quid, you could get a few lessons and really improve your riding.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. I've benefited from some hours of coaching myself. It had a huge impact for I think I've done 3 days maybe, and it was insane how much difference it made. So
yeah, it's amazing. Like all the time guiding as well. So much of the time you'd start riding with someone and it'd be something really little, like their handlebars would be rolled really far forwards, or their peak would be on their helmet would be down over their eyes and stopping them looking ahead on the trail. And it's like a 1 second piece of advice that might just improve their riding infinitely. So just to get someone to look at what you're doing, give you a few tips, can make a massive difference.
For sure. All right. Second question. If you could sit down with yourself age 16, how old are you now, James?
33.
33. Okay. So if you could go back to your 16-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
Yeah, I find that a hard one to answer because I'm definitely of the school of like having no regrets, but I'd probably just say the same as, like I said, the mountain guide Nick Parks told me, which is just to follow your passion and try and carve yourself a career somehow in that. I'd say that again.
It feels like you've let things come to you. You've been very open to the doors that have been put in front of you. Let the universe come to you almost in a bit of a cheesy phrase, but it feels like that you've not you've not searched for it. It's you've just let it happen.
Is yeah, and I've fair? Been I've been fortunate to be privileged enough to like float around and just do, you know, building jobs and stuff like that, and see where next opportunity takes me. I know that's not like that for everybody. So yeah, I mean, but I've tried to, if there's any opportunity out there, just explore it and see where it goes, and then take it or leave it after that.
And you've always had that, I guess, that fallback of going and doing a bit of building work or whatever to bring in a bit of money if you need it.
Yeah, lived in a time and society where that's possible to sort of just go and get some work like that and keep yourself afloat. And when I was traveling around, when, like I said, early 20s, with my mates in a van, it didn't cost us very much at all to travel around. Diesel was cheap. We were lucky to get our bikes given to us most of the time, and most of our kit and stuff like that, and managed to wangle a few sponsors. So we were lucky to have that opportunity to be able to do that. But on any scale, you can still do that. Yeah,
you can live cheap, definitely. Don't need to spend a lot of money.
No.
Yeah. Cool. All right, third question. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
I think, I mean, I look at Greg Minnaar and I'm just like, wow, that's just such a phenomenal, not just for his actual riding, which is incredible, but for his whole outlook and everything, and his longevity. I'd probably try to get some tips from him. I don't think there's anyone more qualified to give out advice.
Yeah, fair comment. Yeah, and I wouldn't put another win past him this season either, to be fair.
Not at all. He's still firing him, and he loves it, and he loves everything about it. You can tell, just traveling, riding, racing, being part of the scene, the community and everything. You can tell that it's not like Steve Pete as well, you know, it's not just for a paycheck or for ego or something. It's because they actually genuinely love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair play. All right. Final question. What is something that you do every day that you think benefits you?
Reading, from my point of view, just reading quality material. So not just reading Instagram posts and online stuff, just trying to read stuff that's been printed, because if it's been printed, it's almost definitely been totally labored over by someone, because they know they can't go back once it's printed. And they've got a team around them probably who've then checked it and edited it and given them feedback, and they've thought about every single part of it that goes in. And you can learn, I mean, from my point of view, I try and learn about the skill of writing, but you can learn all sorts from reading. You can find all sorts of interesting stories out, and it can change your whole mindset. Reading a quality, it's something that's a lot of time and effort put into, it can really change your way of thinking. And you can't really get that from, you can get it from online stuff, but it's less likely. And also because we're in a rush when we're online, usually we don't really invest time in reading stuff. So yeah, magazines, books.
What's the best thing you've read recently?
Good question. A couple of years ago, I got subscriptions to, I thought I need to go outside of just sports and stuff like that in terms of magazines. So I'll get subscriptions to some sort of well-known magazines. So I'll get The New Yorker and Private Eye. So Private Eye is obviously just really funny satire, taking the piss out of everything that's bad and good in the world and politics and stuff. New Yorker just will have any old stuff. You know, it could have a feature on economics, could have a feature on a sporting event or the environment or something like that. So, and they're always amazingly well researched and written. But yeah, any of those kind of classic titles, I recommend actually reading them. I used to think it was just, you know, for kind of snobs, but just actually, if you want to read some quality articles, that's where you've got to go, I think.
Yeah, fair play. I have to check them out. All right. If people want to find out a bit more about Misspent Summers, want to check out the books and the merch, where do they head?
So our website is misspentsummers.com. And it's, I suppose that's a one-stop shop for everything like that, really. We do social media as well, but it's not at all our kind of goal to sort of build it up too much. So best place, just go on our website. Or if you want to go on Instagram, then just look up Misspent Summers. And yeah, you can find out everything on there and sign up to our newsletters, because that's where we do most of our communications through, really, now. We're starting to.
Okay.
Just kind of nurture our the sort of people who invest in our company and believe in us. So sort of do offers and freebies through there, and just a little bit of news from inside the company, and ask our supporters what they think of our products and how we can improve and stuff like that.
Awesome. Good stuff, man. Well, yeah, thanks a lot for taking the time out for a chat today. It's been super interesting finding out a bit more about you and what goes on behind the scenes of these awesome books that you guys put out. So yeah, thanks a lot for that, and look forward to seeing more from you, and also checking out Tea and Biscuits in a few days when it comes out.
Thank you very much. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to be on here. It's, like I said, it's an honor. Like, the podcast is the best one that's out there, and always well presented, well researched, interesting to listen to. So really, honestly, an honor to come on here. Thanks very much.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate that. It's really kind of you. Cool. Well, enjoy the rest of your weekend, man. And yeah, hopefully see you at some races soon.
Cheers. And see you around soon.
Cheers, dude.
Thanks.
All right, that's it for this episode with James. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A big thanks to We Are One Composites for their support. Don't forget that as a Downtime listener, you can get 15% off their stock wheels and the depackaged bar and stem until the end of April by using the code HANDLAID2020. That's HANDLAID2020, all in lowercase. Head to weareonecomposites.com now and check out what they have to offer. Also, don't forget that if you want to have a read of some of the awesome Misspent Summers books or get hold of their 2020 calendar, then you can get 10% off until the 15th of March using the code DOWNTIME, all lowercase, at the checkout. There are plenty of great books there, and you can also get yourself a bundle and get up to speed with all the back issues of Hurley Burley and the World Stage book. Thanks to everyone who's donated over the last few months to keep the podcast going. It's been super touching to see how many of you value what I'm doing. You can still donate or get hold of some exclusive Downtime merch over at downtimepodcast.com/shop. If you've got a couple of minutes, please leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the show. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then you can share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, keep on spreading the word, telling your friends about the podcast and sharing the episodes on your social media. It all helps a lot. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, get out and ride.